Hi. Good morning. It's good to see you. It's good to be here this morning. I really appreciate the opportunity to be with you this morning. I'm just looking forward to what God has for us. I always count it a privilege anytime anybody allows me to speak and listen to what I have to say, and just hope that pray that God's words will be what we're actually hearing today. So let's just have a word of prayer, and then we will get into the word. Father, I just thank you so much for who you are. Lord, the sunshine outside, the breeze, the popping out of the leaves, it just reminds us that there is life in this world that we live in. And that life traces back to your life, the life that you gave us. And I just ask today, Lord, that you would remove those barriers that might prevent us from receiving the life of Christ, the things that so easily beset us. Lord, help us to set those things aside today. And just believe that there is something real and living and good about what you offer us. And I pray, Lord, that you would just say something to us today and that we might have ears to listen and that might lodge in a place in our spirits that would do something positive and bring us to a deeper point of relationship with you. We ask all these things in Jesus' name, just believing that you are real and that you desire and long to give good gifts to your children. Thanks so much for all you do in your name. Amen. I take a little survey here. I do it with the kids at the school sometimes, and I won't be judgmental at all after I get the results. But how many of you have read one of the prophets, one of the prophetic books in the last, let's say, month? Wow. You're not seeing what I'm seeing. How many of you have read one? Now, the prophets are loosely divided up into the major prophets, the larger prophets like Isaiah, Jeremiah, then there's what they are often called the minor prophets, which is Micah, Obadiah, guys like that. How many of you have read a minor prophet in the last month? Okay, a few of you. All right, good. And I'm always encouraged when anybody reads them because, let's just be honest. A lot of the prophets are not exactly smooth sailing. There's a lot of stuff to go through. It's not always real uplifting, some of the things the prophets had to say to us. And, many people just kind of choke on it. It's like, that's much rather read the Gospels, the Psalms, things that kind of seem to speak more directly to us. But there is a minor tragedy to that, because if you really read the prophets, if you take the time to let them really sink in and wade through some of the stuff, they are probably the most modern of all the books of the Bible, in the sense that many of the same problems that I hear in 21st century America, problems people have with God, answers that don't seem to get provided, those things are in the prophets. The prophets spend a lot of time speaking to the people, but also to God, and God spends a lot of time speaking back to them. And he says some things, and he draws some conclusions and some illustrations that are bracingly real, sometimes uncomfortably so. And I find that if I can just spend a little time wading through some of that stuff, then sometimes the place that I get is a pretty good place. Now, I'm gonna start you off on a real offbeat note here. My wife, for some reason that I do not fully know, some years purchased a copy of the Street Bible. Got it for $2.99 at Walmart. Now, this is not scripture. The guy that did it does not claim that it is, and I wouldn't read it to you if he did. But basically, he went through and kind of put some of the Bible stories in, shall we say, modern language. And I want to read introduction to a minor prophet book and see what you think about this. Now, starts off like this. When God starts using Hosea as a courier, first thing he says is, go find a tart, marry her, have kids with her. Why? Because Israel's a tart, guilty as charged, walking out in our relationship and having affairs with other gods. So he arranges a wedding with Gomer and has babies with her. That's the start of the book of Hosea in the Street Bible. Now, the actual Bible puts it just a little bit differently, and that's where we're going to live today. Now, first of all, I do understand that there are children here, and there are some slightly thin ice. I'm going to be speaking in generalities at times, but this is Bible, folks, and I think there's some real... there's some real, real things that God has to say to us through it. In verse 2 of Hosea chapter 1, it says, when God first spoke through Hosea, the Lord said to him, go and take yourself a wife of harlotry and have children of harlotry, for the land commits flagrant harlotry, forsaking the Lord. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. And the Lord said to him, "Name him Jezreel, for yet a little while, and I will punish the house of Jehu for the bloodshed of Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. And it will come on that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel." Then she conceived again and gave birth to a daughter. And the Lord said to him, "Name her Lo-ruhamah, for I will no longer have compassion on the house of Israel that I should ever forgive them. But I will take compassion on the house of Judah and deliver them by the Lord their God, and not deliver them by bow, sword, battle horses, or horsemen." Then she weaned Lo-ruhamah, and she conceived and gave birth to a son. And the Lord said, "Name him Lo-ammi, for you are not my people, and I am not your God." Now, those are not terribly comforting words. Now, I'm not sure what Hosea thought when God broke out his feelings of, well, his choice of a wife. Now, we're going to slide by the last two verses of Hosea 1, and we're going to come back to them. We're going to jump ahead. I'm just going to give you a few snatches of the first 13 verses of Hosea 2, because it basically goes in line with the things that are said in Hosea 1, in which all three names of the children that Gomer bore with Hosea have a meaning behind them. Punishment, not my people, not my God, and I will never forgive them. And then as you go throughout the second chapter of Hosea, you get a lot of the same stuff. And he begins to say, why? Why do I feel this way? Because the things I see Israel doing are causing me significant pain. I don't understand it. I don't understand why they go out and do the crazy, mixed up, no good things they do. I'm tired of it. I'm sick of it. And I, frankly, I'm fed up. In verse 12 of chapter 2, it says, "I will destroy her vines and fig trees, of which she said, 'These are my wages, which my lovers have given me.' And I will make them a forest, and the beasts of the field will devour them." Verse 8, "For she does not know that it was I who gave her the grain, the new wine, and the oil, and lavished on her silver and gold, which they used for Baal." And, you know, he just basically runs over. Here's some of the reasons I feel the way I do. It's almost like God is on the couch, and the psychologist says, "Tell me how you really feel. You want to know how I feel? This is how I feel. I don't feel good about this at all. I don't understand. I don't get it." God seems alarmingly like us in this time. Now, again, none of that comes off as comfort. It's not meant to come off as comfort. None of it is real easy to listen to. It's not meant to be real easy to listen to. But if you begin to think about it, in that interplay of relationship in which we find ourselves in our everyday lives, first of all, we get an opportunity here to get a sense of how God feels, how God looks at things. You know, we're real used to us. We know we have problems. We know we have issues. We know we mess up probably more than we should. And we know God is gracious. But God in this collection of verses essentially is saying, this is the way I see it. This is how it makes me feel. And if that seems a little bit judgmental to you, a lot of you in here have kids. How do we feel when our kids run away, do things they shouldn't do, frustrate us, just make us feel ways that we don't want to feel? We don't like it. In fact, most any relationship is going to... Real relationships, deep relationships, relationships that matter, things that we really commit time to, is going to most likely involve some things that we don't enjoy, some things that we don't like. I a few years ago read an article about a baseball manager who's been in the business for a while, Tony La Russa, and he has a real reputation as an old school guy. He's been with the Cardinals for a while. He was with the A's before that, and he said I love managing baseball. I love being around the guys. I understand it's provided me a good living and a really nice life. But, you know, some of this, and I'll definitely paraphrase some of his words here, he said, there is some really rough stuff that goes on in this. He said, you know, you sell yourself out for a certain guy, and you stick with him through an injury, and you support him when management wants you to cut him. And then after all that, he sells you out. And he undercuts you and tries to go behind your back and go to management and say he didn't like you. And that's a little bit hard. I don't like that. You know, with leadership itself, whether it's parenthood or, you know, I'm the principal of a school. You know, I almost think in order to do it well, you have to be able to hurt. There are times where I'll go home and I kind of have this catatonic stare, and my wife will say, "What are you thinking? What's on your mind?" And what's on my mind? It's this certain kid that's on my mind who is driving me crazy. Not just because they're doing such horrible things because I see them walking away from the Lord one step at a time. And I feel like I know what it is they should be doing. And I'd like to get them to do what they should be doing. And they're not doing it. And I really don't have, I may have a certain amount of power over them to punish or to encourage or to discipline. But on matters of the heart, I can't make them want it. And it kills. You stay up late at night thinking about what you did wrong and what you could do better and what you might be able to do tomorrow, thinking about all these words you want to say. And yet, you know, in the end, every single syllable could be rejected. And then maybe you get a little sense of a little tiny minute sense. And I've said it many times at the school to the point that my staff probably gets sick of it. Maybe then we get a tiny little vision into what God goes through dealing with us. Frustration, the why don't they just get it? And then sometimes the anger and the outrage. And it's righteous anger in a sense. Obviously, with God, it's always righteous anger. God says, I'm sick of this. And then in the first 9 verses of chapter 1, he says, I'm never taking them back. They're not my God. I'm not their God anymore, and they're not my people. And then in verse 10 of chapter 1, he says, yet the number of the sons of Israel will be like the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. And it will come about that in the place where it is said to them, you are not my people, it will be said to them, you are the sons of the living God. And the sons of Judah and the sons of Israel will be gathered together. And they will appoint for themselves one leader, and they will go up from the land, for great will be the day of Jezreel. Now, the last word of chapter 1, Jezreel, that was also mentioned in verse 4 as a sign of judgment. Now, he says, I'm going to punish Jehu. We won't go too deep into this. Was a king who was assigned to vent God's judgment on the house of Ahab and Jezebel, and he did. Then he got a little carried away and started got a little power drunk and did some things he shouldn't have done. And God said, "I didn't like that, and I'm going to punish it. And I'm going to punish this. And I'm going to punish that. And I am done with them. And I am through with them. And I will never take them back." And then he says, "I'm going to take them back." That's in verse 10 and 11. And it gets deeper in the second part of chapter 2. I will allure her. I will bring her into the wilderness, verse 14, and speak kindly to her. Then I will give her the vineyards from there, and the valley of Achor, and a door of hope. And she will sing there as in the days of her youth, as in the day where she came up from the land of Egypt. And in that day, declares the Lord, that you will call me Ishi, and you will no longer call me Baali. For I will remove the names of the Baals from her mouth, so that they will be mentioned by those names no more. And it goes on to say, you know, well, and I go all the way down to verse 23. I will not say to those who were not my people, and I will say to those who were not my people, you are my people. And they will say, thou art my God. Now, this back and forth, I'm sick of them. I want them back. I'll never take them back. I'll take them back. I don't care what they do. I'll never take them back. If they would just come back to me, I'll take them back. This is not uncommon in the prophets, this almost schizophrenic side, which makes it difficult when you look at an unchanging God to figure out what in the world he's talking about. You know, or is he through with them or is he not through with them? Will he never take him back or will he take him back? And the answer is yes. And that still makes it a little bit strange. As I said a moment or so ago, that kind of interplay. Now, first I said it about the I'm angry, I'm tired of this, I'm angry with you. Not only is that not uncommon with God and the prophets, it's also not uncommon in human relationships, especially those primary human relationships, marriage, child rearing, family, I remember the film Parenthood, where the one character is so frustrated with her teenage daughter who's promiscuous and you know, starting to flunk out of school and all this stuff, and then she decides she's going to move out of the house and then with her boyfriend, and she says, Julie, if you walk out that door, don't you ever come back. If you walk out that door, you will never come in here with my daughter again. And then Julie leaves, and then she goes out in the lawn. She says, Julie, honey, make sure you know that I'm always here for you. You know, I'll if you ever want to come back. You know, I'm not so very far down the path with my parenting. My kids are 14 and 10, but I already get that sense. You know, they're always going to be my kids. I don't think that will probably change when they're 24 and 20 or 34 and 30. You certainly hope there's going to be a lot of joy in that, and there has been. But you know, there's going to be some pain too. back and forth it goes. In the wild vastness of God's love, in the amazingness of who he is, there is that plumb line of this is the way it is for their good, for their prosper. This is the way it has to be, and I am not going to compromise on that of the inch. And then there is grace that just seems to roll through that and roll over it. And God says, I'll take them back. But in fact, I'm going to find ways for them to be restored in an amazing and remarkable way. If you know the story, the full story of Hosea and Gomer, in chapter 3, God says, in the verse 1 of chapter 3, the Lord said to me, go again, love a woman who is loved by her husband, yet an adulteress, even as the Lord loves the sons of Israel. So they turned to other gods and love raisin cakes. So I bought her for myself for 15 shekels of silver and a homer and a half of barley. Then I said to her, you shall stay with me many days. You shall not play the harlot, nor shall you have any other man. So I also will be toward you. For the sons of Israel remained for many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred pillar, and without ephod or household idols. Afterward, the sons of Israel will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king, and they will come trembling to the Lord and to his goodness in the last days. How much cost? First of all, when Hosea went to buy his wife back, I won't get unnecessarily graphic here, but those slave markets were not a pretty place. They were not a pretty place in terms of what condition Gomer likely would have been when she was brought up for market. They were not a pretty place in terms of any respectable person being found there. But that's where he went, the prophet. I'm going to bring that home a little more in just a few minutes. But that was the price. That was the cost. And loving something is not always a real pretty thing either, at least in the terms that we would define pretty. I remember on a far different level, I saw a comic some years ago of these two married people, and the husband's coming out in the morning. He's got his old tattered bathrobe on and hair sticking here and there, a 12 o'clock shadow on his face, and the woman makes a comment, I guess, to a friend of hers on the phone, and she says, marriage is not for the squeamish. In other words, if you're going to be married, you're going to see things in different times and different places that maybe weren't quite like when you were dating. I dated a girl once who said to me, she said, whenever I get married, she said, I'm going to wake up before my husband gets up, and I'm going to make sure I get cleaned up and put my makeup on and everything so he didn't have to see me, without makeup. Well, that's not the girl that I ended up married. I would love to talk to her husband now and know if that actually happened. I'm kind of doubting it, personally. We get to a far, far deeper level with all that. And we know that love pulls things out of us and takes us to places and exposes us to experiences that pretty much nothing else would. Or at least, we probably wouldn't put up with some of the things that love can drag us to and drag us through, were it not for that very thing, that crazy little thing called love. Can, again, drag things out of us that nothing else will, especially in our primary relationships, but sometimes in ways that are a little more off-center even than that. Hosea's wife was not faithful to him. Hosea was called to buy her back, and that's exactly what he did. Now, there are two ways to approach this. Obviously, and it's the way we've been approaching this, this serves as a metaphor for God's covenant love with Israel, that he is... that he is in the business of redeeming many things, but he was in the business of redeeming his people. And despite all they had done and all they had been through and all he had taken them through, and you can plainly see from this, he feels it. He is not just a faceless entity up there in the sky. He is a person who rages and loves and hurts in much the same way that we do. And you can see in this that he cares about all that, that he cares about us. Just a sidebar to all that. Please keep in mind, when you read through God's, fulminations about Israel, that Israel hadn't really, in one sense, totally abandoned God. They had just mixed in their worship of God with many other things. They had hedged their bets in a lot of ways to fertility gods and other things that brought with them pagan fertility rituals and other stuff. And God said, I don't like it. And I think, before we have cast too jaundiced of an eye on anybody else, we should remember that we are also, in many ways, prone to wonder prone to mix in our worship of the one true living God with worship of a lot of other things too. And God doesn't like it. And yet, His grace abounds. Now, if all that doesn't hit you at a real personal level, let me just draw in a story. A story of a pastor. Let's say a 52-year-old Baptist pastor. A little gray around the temples, a degree from a respectable Bible college and a reputable seminary, who spent all of his life in the ministry. His kids are basically raised. They're pretty much out of the house. And for that and another reason, he's alone because his wife died several years prior from cancer. And he's now kind of resigned himself for the rest of his life to doing the work of the ministry, giving himself to his church, and just being that respectable, hardworking, loving pastor that he's always been and now has kind of sadly a little more time to be. So as he goes about the ministry and works at his church, he finds a little more time on his hands. And more than just the time that's on his hands, there's a little something missing in his heart. So he decides, well, maybe there's something else I can do with this tainted gift, in a sense, that God's given me later in life. So he begins volunteering time down at a homeless mission that ministers to people who have drug issues or have been homeless for one reason or another. He begins to spend time serving meals and then using that minor in pastoral counseling that he had back in his Bible college days to start doing a little counseling with the people that come through the place. He finds that there's something meaningful about that, that's maybe meaningful at a level that he hadn't quite felt standing from the pulpit and giving a sermon. He goes on with that, and then as one day he encounters a lady that comes through. She's not 52, she's 27, and she's had an extremely checkered past. She's been into drugs, she's had a lot of scarred relationships, and she has at times participated in the world's oldest profession as part and parcel with that. He counsels her, he talks to her, and eventually she begins to get her life together, begins to do things that she ought to do, and expresses a real interest in walking with the Lord. And eventually she's out of the homeless shelter, and he, through his church, funds a down payment of an apartment, and she begins to get her life together and starts to work. And he continues to counsel her and have a relationship with her, purely professional. And then as the relationship gets to be just a little more than a relationship, he feels this strange nudging that he couldn't explain to anybody else. He can't even totally explain to herself. Marry her. She needs stability. She needs somebody who will love her just for her, not for all the other reasons that people have loved her. So he does. Raises a little bit of a stir in the Baptist church. The respectable 52-year-old pastor marrying a 27-year-old person with an extremely checkered past. But he explains it from the pulpit, and people basically come to accept it, although there's certainly a few whispers around the community. They settle in, and they begin to have a life together. Even a few children are born, later in life, which is also a little different. But then there begin to be a few other whispers. She's been seen around the wrong part of town at the wrong time of night. And that kind of gets back to him, but he dismisses it. He talks to her a time or two about it. Well, I'm going back there to talk to and see some of the people I used to be with, try and offer them the same help that I had. And he accepts that. Then the whispers get a little bit louder. And then they become a little bit more than whispers. And as much as he tries to ignore them, and the times he's talked to his wife, now it's getting a little bit out of hand. One day he wakes up to an empty house, and she's gone. And he hears that she's back in her old life. He doesn't know what to do. He can't even find her. One day, a few months later, as he's driving down the street, he sees her on the streets, looking pretty much like she looked when she came into the homeless shelter. And what in the world is he going to do about that? He doesn't know what to do. Prays about it, fasts about it, asks God what to do about it. And one day he says, you know what, I need to go get her. So he goes to a place with his tie and his suit, in a place where people with ties and suits aren't usually found, to a run-down abandoned building. It's being staffed by a man and several girls, and he goes in and he says, I'm here to get my wife back. And the guy says, well, she's kind of my property now. He says, well, I'm here to get her back. He says, well, I wouldn't really mind giving her back to you. She's HIV positive. She's not really worth much to me anymore anyway. But you got to understand, she owes me a significant amount of money, over $20,000 for the money I lent her to finance her drug habit. You can't just take her. So the man goes back. He gets a second mortgage on his house. He gets the $20,000, and he goes back and buys her back. And he says, "You're mine now. Don't ever leave again." Now, that story is partially made up, and it's also partially real. I used to be a drug counselor, and some of you might know. But it brings it home a little bit, what it must be like for somebody to truly step beyond the bounds of the normal to love somebody who has not earned their love. And then we get it at a whole different level. What was it like to God, for God, to step beyond the bounds of the normal to love us? I can't really answer that question. I can only illustrate. There's one more way to hit this, and then we'll be done. Why would God tell somebody to marry a woman like this? What in the world is that all about? Why does God sometimes take us far beyond our borders? Why sometimes when a person asks God for bread, the stones seem to rain down from heaven? What's that all about? What is God up to? One of my favorite passages in the entire Bible is when Ezekiel, the prophet, is told to lay on his side for 3 years with his arm pointing to Israel. And God says, while you're there, you're going to cook your bread over dried human dung. That's going to be your daily lot. And Ezekiel says, miser paraphrase here, "God, that's too much. Cooking my bread over dried human dung? I don't like that." So the Lord says, "Okay, all right, fine. You can cook your bread over dried cow dung." I'm reading this and I'm thinking, Lord, couldn't you have at least bought Ezekiel a microwave? I mean, come on. Is it not enough that he's laying on his side for 3 years with his arm pointing towards Israel? And now, you know, but yeah, you did let up a little bit. A little bit. You know, on a very personal level. You know, I think someday about, when my kids are of age, you know, I pray a lot for my daughter's future husband. You know, Lord, make him really nice and really strong, or at least one of those things. I think about, my son and, sometimes I'll say, you know, Lord, put in 60, 70-hour weeks here at the school. I've given the best years of my life to this place. Maybe you could, you know, find my son a nice wife among the people, you know, the girls here someday. That doesn't seem so unreasonable, does it? If he comes down with this choice of mates and says God told him to, I'm probably going to say, have you really listened to God, son? What's that really all about? I don't know completely what it's all about. But I will say this. Sometimes the circumstances of this life, however good or however bad, and God makes it very plain that he is not happy with all the bad. And yet in the midst of that, God says, sometimes the varnish just needs to be stripped off of all the stuff that goes on planet Earth. All the things that we count as important. All the things that we run after and say, you know what? There is real good, there is real bad, and there is a real struggle. And it wakes us up to the fact that this life is more than just paying bills and getting to work and trying to, you know, get this kid to that sporting event and that kid to the other one. And to say, you know, there are very, very large things at stake here. And you're a part of that. You are a player in this grand story, this grand drama that God is somehow writing. And it gets us awake not just to the struggle, but also to the cost of what God is doing on planet Earth. That amount that Jose paid for Gomer. Now it says he paid 15 shekels, but it also says that he paid. It also says that he paid partially with some barley and some different grain products, probably because he didn't have all the money. Now the total typical price of what it cost to buy somebody off market down there was 30 shekels. Now that reminds me of a song years ago that I heard. And I didn't handle hearing the song very well. It was some years ago out in western Pennsylvania at my wife's grandmother's church, which, to be quite blunt, was pretty dry and pretty vacuous. And we were just kind of going through this and that and the other thing. And, And then in the middle of all that, these two guys stand up, they get their guitars, they strap them on, and they start singing a song. And it went something like this. 30 shekels of silver, 30 pieces of shame. I heard this. It was pretty country western. So I'm just kind of taking this. This is not anything like I had heard the whole rest of the service. And then in the middle of something, I'm handling it. I'm taking it in. I'm with it. And then all at once, they stop singing, and the one guy starts kind of, you know, hammering away on the guitar, and the other guy starts country western rapping about 30 shekels of silver and 30 pieces of shame. And, yeah, I lost it. Fortunately, I didn't lose it. I didn't dissolve in tears. I dissolved in laughter. And fortunately, my son was sitting on my lap at the time. He was one. So I put him up in front of me so I could sort of laugh into his diaper. And it just really knocked me off balance. That the country western rapping, I wasn't quite ready for that. I thought it was good. I thought it was really good, but I've never forgotten that song. I've never forgotten the 30 pieces of silver and the 30 shekels of shame. And I'm only telling that silly little story just to imprint it a little more on your mind that what Jose paid to buy Gomer back is what Jesus Christ's love was sold for, 30 shekels. And I don't think the amount is by accident. There's a struggle. There's a cost. And of course, the cost for Jesus went a long way beyond 30 shekels. It gets us also awake to the wonder of what grace is really all about. I heard a story some years ago about a guy that was in prison who came to know the Lord. He said, "You want to know why I came to know the Lord? I'll tell you why." He said, "This crazy preacher came in and started talking to me about Jesus, and I spit in his face and cursed him out and told him to never come back again. Next day he was there, and I did the same thing. And the next day he was there, and I did the same thing. And the next day he was there, and I did the same thing. And he kept coming and coming and coming. And every single time he did, I would spit in his face and curse him out and tell him to never come back again. And he kept coming back. And eventually I figured, there must be something behind all this. This guy must be tapping into a deeper well." And that's exactly the point. When Jesus tells us to go the extra mile and turn the other cheek and do a whole lot of other stuff that is way beyond where I would normally go and what I would normally do, what that does is it reveals something beyond what we would normally do. It reveals a love beyond what we would normally love. It takes us to places we have not been before. It stretches us in ways we probably don't want to be stretched. We're changed, and possibly the world is in the bargain. The real worth in this life seems to be bound up in relationships and cost and many of the things that at the time seemed far beyond us. I find when I go to funerals, first of all, I don't find too many dead people who are atheists there. We all want to talk about how they really knew the Lord. But second of all, I often find that what we all often end up talking about is sacrifice, difficulty, people giving up something for somebody else. Those are the things that people want to remember because those are the things that stick. The real worth in life, I'm going to say it again, seems bound up in relationships which require more of us than we would have ever given on our own. Because then we find out about something that is not truly our own. It is the love of God being given to us, through us, around us, in ways which are entirely unreasonable. I can't say exactly what that means to you today. And quite honestly, I can't say entirely what that means to me either. I do know there is a cost. And I do know that that cost, that brim of sacrifice, tends to, I believe, one day will have the cup overflowing in ways which are far beyond what we ever invested. I'm going to read you the end of Jose, part of it, and then we will be done. Chapter 14, it's one of the longer minor prophets, actually, and verse 5. "I will be like the dew to Israel. He will blossom like the lily, and he will take root like the cedars of Lebanon. His shoots will sprout, and his beauty will be like the olive tree, and his fragrance like the cedars of Lebanon. Those who live in his shadow will again raise grain, and they will blossom like the vine. His renown will be like the wine of Lebanon. O Ephraim, what more have I to do with idols? It is I who answer and look after you. I am like a luxuriant cypress, for from me comes your fruit. Whoever is wise, let him understand these things. Whoever is discerning, let him know them. For the ways of the Lord are right, and the righteous will walk in them, but transgressors will stumble in them. Walking after Jesus, following Christ, is a lot more than we make it out to be sometimes. It stretches us, it shapes us, it molds us, it changes us. As we ask God to give us what we would never stumble onto ourselves, we're changed, and just maybe somebody else has changed in the bargain. But in the end, that's their business. The biggest thing I've taken out of 20 years in ministry, whatever exactly that means, is that in the end, you're left with one thing and one thing only: what God did in your life. You really don't know the rest of it. You hope, you believe, you pray that something stuck, but in the end, you're left with what God did for you. And indeed, He does do a lot. Father God, we are not Jose, and yet maybe in some sense we are. Perhaps called today to love somebody at a level we don't want to. Perhaps called to give in a way that we don't feel we can. Perhaps called to lay our lives down in some way like you did, although certainly not in the same way. Help us to follow you, Lord, because you're worth following. The cost, the pain, the sacrifice, the love, the reward, it all flows from you. We thank you and praise you, Father, for who you are, for what you continue to do in our lives, and what you will continue to do in our lives as we place our faith and trust in you. In Jesus' name.